Hi, everybody. My name is Dr. Corey Tischauer. I'm a naturopathic physician with the Bear Creek Naturopathic Clinic here in Medford, Oregon. I've been in practice for 15 years, focusing on treatment of chronic infectious illness, environmental medicine, and immune dysfunction in chronic illness, neurodegenerative conditions, and a variety of functional problems that the conventional medical system struggles to treat. My talk today is going to be on immune dysfunction in chronic and post-treatment Lyme disease and how we can use low-dose naltrexone to reduce the chronic inflammation associated with these conditions. Slide two. So the first thing I'd like to do is start with some definitions of terms. Post-treatment Lyme syndrome is a word that many people have heard of and probably struggle to understand because it's used interchangeably with chronic Lyme disease. And in fact, these are likely two different conditions, but yet both of them are present. Post-treatment Lyme syndrome is something that many clinicians who deal with this have probably encountered these scenarios. And the things that I hear from my patients, the feedback, can be summarized by a few things. This idea that I've treated my Lyme infection aggressively, yet I still continue to have symptoms. Or every lab that I do is negative since I finished treatment, but I'm still symptomatic. You also hear, if I stop treatment, my symptoms always come back, so I have to stay on therapy, otherwise I'll end up getting sick again. Or no matter how much treatment I do, no matter how many doctors I see, no matter how much I spend, I never feel completely better. I'm always sick. Slide three. So how many people actually end up having this phenomena happen? It's a rather common condition, unfortunately, and I think these numbers are pretty consistent with what I see in my practice. But it's been shown that 10 to 20% of patients will continue to experience lingering symptoms of fatigue, musculoskeletal pain, insomnia, brain fog, and other functional conditions following appropriate single or even multiple treatment courses. 10 to 20%, now that's a lot. Post-treatment Lyme syndrome is defined as the persistence of symptoms more than 6 months following an effective treatment. And this is an effective treatment regardless of whether you're going to follow the Infectious Disease Society of America guidelines of 3 weeks of an antibiotic, or whether you're going to utilize the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society guidelines and use more long-term therapies on these people. But they're still symptomatic following 6 months of treatment, and that is post-treatment Lyme syndrome. Slide four. Now let's juxtapose that with chronic Lyme disease. Chronic Lyme disease is different from post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, but it has similar symptoms. And the difference between chronic Lyme and post-treatment Lyme is the organism itself. And I would postulate that in chronic Lyme disease, we're actually dealing with an active infection that is still causing tissue damage. It's not the immune system that's solely responsible for the problem, but that this organism is still active. And chronic Lyme is a phenomena that you see occurring for a variety of reasons, as I've described here, some of them. Inadequate treatment duration. Maybe they did need 6 weeks or 12 weeks or longer of treatment instead of three. Improperly chosen medications or therapies. You know, the one day of doxycycline isn't going to work. Maybe you need more than one antibiotic. Maybe you need to add more herbs. Maybe you need to do other things or do hyperbaric or do IV or whatever. The presence of still undiagnosed or untreated co-infections. You missed the Bartonella, the Babesia, like mycoplasma, whatever it may be, or comorbid conditions or other environmental illness, Again, for those of us working in this area, things like mold exposures, heavy metals are known to hamper the immune response and contribute to the persistence of active infection. And if you don't get out of those environments, you may not be able to eliminate this active organism. Slide five. So the common denominator in both post-treatment Lyme syndrome and chronic Lyme disease, as I would argue, is bacterial persistence. There's a lot of argument between ILADS and IDSA about whether or not the organism is there and so on and so forth. And what I'm going to say is neither person is right and neither side is wrong. The reality is that Borrelia likely survives in our bodies once we've acquired it. Now, there's hundreds of studies that demonstrate that Borrelia can still be found in human hosts following multiple antibiotic rounds. And there's a lot to describe why this organism can continue to survive in a human host despite the use of these antimicrobial therapies. And some of these, and this is certainly by no means exhaustive, include persister cells. It's been a hot topic in the last few years, as described by Dr. Zhang and popularized a lot by Dr. Richard Horowitz. The presence of cystic forms of this organism, also known as round bodies. The ability for Borrelia to move into immune-privileged sites where there's very poor capillary perfusion and the immune system is not able to access as well. The ability to immune modulate the host and actually reduce our ability to attack this organism. Biofilm formation, which shelter colonies of Borrelia and prevent antimicrobials from actually penetrating. Variation in surface proteins on the bacteria itself and plasmid exchange, which prevents immune recognition, are all some of the contributing factors that we see that assist in the ability of this organism to persist. Slide six. So this is just a very short list of, I believe, more than 400 citations I have on my computer alone showing that Borrelia can continue to survive in the human body. Slide seven. So as we sort of discussed this idea of chronic Lyme and post-treatment Lyme syndrome relating to bacterial persistence. So we know in chronic Lyme that there's an active infection still present. Well, in the other scenario, what we would see is latent infections, this idea that the organism is still surviving in our body but not causing tissue damage. And this is, in fact, a model that medicine accepts readily because there's many, many opportunistic organisms that already live in the human body and don't cause us damage unless we end up getting an immune response to them. And some of the things we know of can be, you know, anything from Pseudomonas to Proteus in the bowel or Bacteroides, propriobacteria that live on our skin and we don't have acne, we don't have inflammatory bowel diseases because we have Mycobacter, but these organisms are present in us. And so what I would say is that with Borrelia persisting in our bodies, it's going to create difficulty with testing. A lot of testing right now is based on the idea of being able to recognize the presence of the organism. And that can be through antibody-mediated studies, or you may find a popular study now is doing what's called a urinary PCR that's looking for the presence of DNA in a patient's urine. Well, if you have a latent infection, you have an organism that's surviving in the body in any of these numbers, these immune-privileged sites, wherever, but actually not causing tissue damage, you will continue to see DNA present in low levels in these latent infections. And in fact, the DNA can persist for extended periods of time, even following an active infection, meaning once you've been exposed to something, you're going to have that DNA in your body. And one model we have for this even is microchimerism, which you see in women who've had children, that we can find presence of fetal DNA from their child decades later in the central nervous system. So we know that it persists. And I would actually argue that as we find DNA in urine for a person who's had Lyme disease that it cannot distinguish between an active and a latent infection. And in fact, many of these urinary PCR studies describe degraded DNA. And in this antigenic shedding may only support the reality of presence rather than active infections. So again, as I state here, antigenic shedding will continue at low levels, even in latent infections due to pathogen replication and turnover, natural breakdown of biofilm, host-cell apoptosis, immune management, and cellular and matrix detoxification of these proteins. So we will continue to shed proteins and DNA that can contribute to immune reactivity, but also create false negatives on testing potentially. Here is a few studies as well. Slide number 8. So here's a few studies that also show that antigenic debris or pieces of dead bacteria can persist following treatment. There's this concept of an AMBER hypothesis, which states the pathogenesis of joint swelling in Lyme arthritis is due to the introduction into the joint space of non-viable spirochetes, or more likely spirochetal DNA or debris enmeshed in host-derived fibrinous or collagenous matrix, just pieces of dead bacteria because you were once infected and you killed it and now that's there. And it may be latent as well. I really like this next statement here. And that says, the detection of spirochetal nucleic acids does not necessarily correlate with the presence of intact metabolically active organisms. Other endpoints that focus on the persistence of spirochetal components, such as DNA and messenger RNA, although of less direct importance to the issue of antibiotic efficacy, might be pertinent in explaining the persistence of inflammation in patients. Now that is a big, powerful statement. This idea that persistence of DNA and messenger RNA may not have much bearing at all to continuing antibiotics, but it can explain why people have persistent inflammation despite appropriate treatment. So let's take this idea of inflammation. Slide number 9. As we start to consider the concept of inflammation in chronic inflammatory illness, I think the first thing we can take as a model is gender disparity, the differences between men and women. Patients who continue to experience chronic Lyme symptoms and have post-treatment Lyme syndrome are significantly more likely to be female than male. Well, it's interesting because this preponderance in women is also seen with other conditions like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, lupus, chemical sensitivity, inflammatory bowel diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, allergic inflammatory illness, and other systemic Th2 autoimmune diseases. Slide number 10. So what would explain this increased immune reactivity in women? There's likely a number of explanations for this, and certainly hormones in men have their own effects, but we know that estrogen suppresses Th1-dependent diseases, but it potentiates Th2-dependent diseases. And this differences between the male and female immune system can suggest that there may be an increased immune reactivity in women that can predispose them to developing specific autoimmune diseases associated with those Th2 responses. And this may have a natural evolutionary explanation because Th2 T helper cytokines tend to have more of an anti-inflammatory response in the end, and it may help in assisting with pregnancy and allowing a woman to prevent any immune concerns during a pregnancy. So this may make a lot of sense, but it can also predispose to some autoimmune inflammatory problems. Slide 11. So as we discuss the idea of immune-mediated inflammation in both chronic Lyme and post-treatment Lyme syndrome, the question is, why is this so important? Well, it's of critical importance, because as you're, as a clinician, trying to understand what to do with a person, this idea of looking at inflammation as it relates to immune reactivity can support your diagnostic assessment. You need to understand the spectrum between immune-mediated inflammation and pathogen-mediated tissue damage, because ultimately, both of those routes can cause the same symptoms in someone. So by understanding, it can assist in decision-making for treatment interventions and helps you as a clinician to create a balance between antimicrobial therapies and immune-based therapies. It's a big spectrum between using an antibiotic and using like something like low-dose immune therapy on the other side. What are you going to do? Or there's a whole range of things in the middle. And ultimately, this model can help to provide a context to better understand how to support long-term healing in your patient. Do you want to balance their adaptive immune response by adding Th1 support, things that are going to increase the innate immune response and assist in removing intracellular infections, and as you would need in an active infection? Or do you want to try and reduce that Th2 reactivity as you would see in a latent infection in these immune-mediated inflammatory scenarios? Do you need to help to quench that? Or do you suspect that this has been a problem that's been chronic enough that there's autoimmune-like phenomena or autoimmune components, and you need to consider the Th17 and Th10 immune components with the T regulatory system and start addressing the patient with more autoimmune-targeted therapies? Slide 12. This is one of my favorite paragraphs here, and it's a great paper to read, but it's the idea of linking inflammation between infection and chronic illness. And I'm going to read this. It states, inflammation drives many chronic conditions that are still classified as autoimmune or immune mediated. Both the innate and adaptive immune responses play critical roles in the pathogenesis of these inflammatory syndromes. Therefore, inflammation is a clear link between infectious agents and chronic diseases. Aberrant cellular and humoral responses to infections can launch the continuum from infection to long-term sequelae. I'm going to read that again. Aberrant cellular and humoral responses to infections can launch a continuum from an infection initially to long-term problems. This is a big jumping off point and establishes this link of inflammation. Slide 13. So let's start to look at what inflammatory markers are associated with post-treatment Lyme syndrome, chronic Lyme, and these inflammatory conditions. One of these is a chemokine known as CCL19. This is highly elevated in post-treatment Lyme syndrome. Now, CCL19 is a chemokine that functions to attract and position T cells, B cells, and dendritic cells for immune response generation. It potentiates these guys and wakes them up and says, be on the alert. Get ready to deal with whatever you find. So it's this hyperactive immune response. It potentiates it. And these elevated CCL19 levels can reflect ongoing immune-driven reactions at sites distal to secondary lymphoid tissue. What does that mean? It means in the tissue, in the areas of dysfunction. So when someone says, I'm always sore, I have this pain constantly, I'm always fatigued, you know, these areas of my body are affected. Well, this idea of CCL19 can explain that, because there may be some organism persisting in that area of the body or in that region, and it's driving this immune response because CCL19 is potentiating the inflammatory reaction. Slide 14. So CCL19 can be considered an early predictive biomarker, and that's summed up with this statement. Individuals with ideally treated early Lyme disease have a greater than 12-fold higher risk of developing post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, 12-fold times higher. It's a huge amount. And if that elevation by 6 or 12 months, if their CCL19 level is higher than 111.67 picograms per mil at 1 month post-treatment. Now, this is a huge statement, because can you imagine if we could do a simple test on any patient who gets Lyme disease and we could predict within a month of treatment whether they're going to go on to have symptoms? It could allow us to start treatment early on with immune interventions. Unfortunately, CCL19, to my knowledge, is not a commercially available lab at this time and has only been done in university studies. So certainly, if anyone out there listening has found a source for running CCL19, please find me and get a hold of me and let me know where that's being done. Slide 15. Another very important marker is the cytokine interleukin-23. Now, IL-23 in post-treatment Lyme syndrome is associated with the stimulation of what's known as our Th17 T cells. And it correlates with the development of post-Lyme symptoms with a p-value of less than 0.02, so highly correlative. And this study here shows that of the patients with detectable IL-23 levels, 61% went on to develop post-Lyme symptoms. And amazingly, every person with levels greater than 230 nanograms per mil went on to develop symptoms associated with post-treatment Lyme symptoms, which is that idea of continuing symptoms beyond 6 months, no matter what you do. And so these are huge numbers between IL-23 and CCL19, because they can tell you between these two who's going to go on to have these problems. Slide 16. So what is the role of interleukin-23? There's a lot of cytokines. IL-23 is involved in the differentiation of Th17 cells. So, and this differentiation is especially potentiated in the presence of TGF-beta and interleukin-6. IL-23 is produced by inflammatory macrophages, resident microglia, dendritic cells, and activated Th17 cells themselves. So while it potentiates Th17, Th17 also produces IL-23, so it self-drives that. IL-23 has been described as a central cytokine involved in autoimmunity and is looked at as a highly promising treatment target for certain inflammatory diseases. Slide 17. IL-23 is found in the skin of patients with psoriasis. It's identified in bowel walls in chronic inflammatory bowel diseases, and it's found in synovial membranes in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. So there's a lot there directly in tissue. There's a medication, Stelara, which I'm going to not try and pronounce the drug name of it, which is an IL-23 and IL-12 inhibitor that's used effectively in the treatment of psoriasis and Crohn's. So we know that by inhibiting IL-23, we can improve these autoimmune diseases. And while that might sound promising in Lyme disease, unfortunately, IL-23 and IL-12 share a certain receptor dimer that causes this medication to inhibit both things. And IL-12 is actually involved in that Th1 response needed for cell-mediated immunity in the innate immune system, and that could lower the ability of our immune system to deal with active infections and in fact, potentially contribute to a latent infection becoming active again. So probably not a good idea for Lyme patients. Maybe one day they'll develop a medication that's very selective for IL-23. Until then, we'll continue to do what we do. Slide 18. So unregulated Th17 T-cell reactivity promotes autoimmunity. These aberrant Th17 responses are implicated in many autoimmune conditions, including rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel, lupus, multiple sclerosis, encephalomyelitis, psoriasis, and type 1 diabetes. So big deal here. And it's interesting because elevations in Th17-associated immune reactivity and cytokines is correlated with many different central neurologic autoimmune diseases. And one model here is they did a knockout study on mice where they genetically prevented them from being able to produce IL-23. And when they did that, what they found is that these mice were not able to produce IL-17 without IL-23. They found that these IL-23 deficient mice had reduced inflammatory IL-6 and TNF levels. And in fact, when they injected these mice with proteolipid protein, which is a myelin antigen used to induce experimental autoencephalitis, that they were not able to do so in these mice. They were unresponsive to the development of autoimmunity against their brain. So clearly, IL-23 has a very, very central role in promoting an autoimmune reaction against antigenic cross-reactions. Slide 19. So Th17 activation of a naive T-cell promotes inflammation and at the same time inhibits tissue repair. There's a double whammy here that goes on. So it's been found that Th17 activates an inflammatory response induced by pre-existing tissue injury. So when you have ongoing inflammation in tissue, as you would see from these reactions as we described, and you get Th17 involved, it's going to amplify that response and continue to perpetuate it. It's like adding gas to a fire. It's been shown that Th17 is synergistic with other cytokines like TNF-alpha, IL-6, and IL-1, leading to that chronic inflammatory process. And this is what I said about this double whammy, because in addition to promoting and adding fuel to the fire and contributing to more inflammation, Th17 activation is also associated with destruction of the extracellular matrix and inhibition of repair and production of extracellular matrix. So as you're continuing that inflammatory response and breaking that tissue down and eroding away, whether it be in a joint space or some other region of the body, it's also preventing repair of that tissue. So it you can see how a degenerative process can really progress rapidly with these Th17 inflammatory reactions. Slide 20. So the question is, what is the role of Th17 in borreliosis? And I use the term borreliosis here because it describes the presence of the bacteria. We're not describing whether it's an active Lyme infection, a chronic Lyme, or a post-treatment Lyme. It's borreliosis. And as I see it, a high Th17-associated immune response, which we know is often accompanied by the presence of autoantibodies, if we correlate those immune responses and those cytokines with chronic Lyme-related symptoms, it could provide us with a new paradigm to understand and treat post-infectious symptoms in patients. Very big. Slide 21. Another indicator of infection-mediated inflammation that those of us in functional medicine come about many times is TGF-beta-1. TGF-beta-1 is a cytokine produced by many different cells, and almost all white blood cells, including T regulatory cells. And it's used to regulate local inflammation. And much of the confusion around TGF-beta-1 comes from the fact that it's described in the literature as having both inflammatory and anti-inflammatory properties. And it's clearly associated with chronic inflammatory responses, as is described in things like mold illness. Well, high levels of TGF-beta are associated with excessive tissue inflammation. And as I describe it, it's like a shutoff valve. When inflammation gets too high in a certain area of our body or in certain regions, enough so that it's damaging the tissue and threatening the host, you have a way of trying to reduce that inflammatory response to that tissue. And TGF-beta is one of those things. As the body increases TGF-beta 1, it'll inhibit T cell proliferation as well as differentiation of naive T cells into the TH1 or TH2 specific responses. And this can reduce the inflammatory response in those tissues. Unfortunately, the other side of TGF-beta 1 is that it also stimulates a systemic inflammatory response and likely immune autoimmune reactivity by activating TH17 T cells. So cutting down on local inflammation, but unfortunately increasing systemic inflammation. Slide 22. So because of this dual property of TGF-beta 1, I think of it as a contributor to the persistence of certain bacteria in a vicious inflammatory cycle. And how you can think of this is because of its impairment on T cell differentiation, TGF-beta 1 will decrease a TH1 response by inhibiting IL-1 and IL-2 induced proliferation of T cells. And that TH1 response is needed for reinforcing the innate immune response and dealing with intracellular infections, as you might see in a chronic Lyme condition where you have that active organism still there. In addition, it has further immune suppressive effects on our innate immune system by exerting immune suppression on CD8 cytotoxic T cells, as well as natural killer cell activity level. And that's something we see a lot of. We test NK cell function in my clinic, and most of the patients who have chronic Lyme or post-treatment Lyme, and it certainly correlates with TGF-beta 1, will have very low levels of NK cell function. So they might have enough numbers, their CD56 levels might look okay, but the function of those natural killer cells is they're lazy, they're not doing anything, and they're not functioning optimally to eliminate or lyse cell membranes in these bacteria. So ultimately, high TGF levels may be associated with reduced neurogenesis and a tilt towards antibody-mediated immune inflammation, as well as contributing to cross-reactive autoimmune reactions. Not good. Slide 23. So this is a great slide. I like this slide a lot because it really sums up how TGF-beta 1 contributes to this inflammatory genesis. You can see here on the right side, as you follow the CD4 helper naive T cell in red there, and you see the TGF-beta 1 inhibiting what they describe as anti-inflammatory T cells, meaning differentiation of T cells into TH1 or TH2 needed to stimulate an immune response. On the other side here, TGF-beta 1 in the presence, that synergism with IL-6 and IL-4, can stimulate pro-inflammatory cells like TH17. That can contribute to autoimmunity, as I mentioned, as well as B cell proliferation, which leads to that TH2, or you might say humoral dominant autoimmune response and persistent inflammation. Slide 24. Another maybe little known or lesser known marker that you will find in inflammatory marker that you'll find in chronic Lyme and in post-treatment Lyme is C4A. C4A is part of the classical complement pathway and has a role in establishing the continuum from persistent infection to chronic inflammation. C4A is described quite a lot in the literature on chronic inflammatory response, as Shoemaker describes for things like mold illness. Well, it's also described by Stricker and Savely in chronic Lyme disease, especially those with predominant musculoskeletal symptoms. It's very high in those in these patients. And not surprisingly, C4A is decreased in Lyme patients who respond to antimicrobial therapy. Do well, your number's going to go down. It's also high in chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. So that brings up the question, and likely they think that many of us know that probably there is some infectious etiology at the heart of fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue that's perpetuating this immune inflammatory response. Slide 25. Another source of inflammation in the body are resident macrophages or microglia, because microglial stimulation will lead to central neurologic inflammation. Microglia are innate immune cells in the central nervous system that are stimulated by infections through toll-like receptors and Fc receptors that detect a portion of the IgG antibody responses for certain antigen-specific antibodies. Chronic stimulation of microglia will drive pro-inflammatory profiles directly in the central nervous system in the brain. Tissue damage, neurodegeneration, and chronic pain accompany neuroimmune activation. It's a big deal because you can get central pain syndrome, which means you can feel pain anywhere if you light the brain up on fire. Slide 26. So neuroborreliosis symptoms, the presence of symptoms that we think of as neurologic in chronic Lyme and post-treatment Lyme syndrome. Well, those symptoms, there's a lot of evidence that those symptoms are glial-driven inflammatory symptoms. And that is where the neurologic impairment comes from. It is from our own immune system reacting. And we see that with upregulation of interleukin-6, interleukin-8, and TNF-alpha. And this study, which is only about a little over a year old, it looks like here, I guess it was about September 2018, incredible study, worth consideration. And I'm going to read the title of this study because it's quite powerful. It's that primary human microglia are phagocytically active and respond to Borrelia with upregulation of chemokines and cytokines. So why is that a big deal? Well, in this study, they looked at the ability of Borrelia to drive glial inflammation. And what they found is that both live Borrelia spirochetes and, interestingly, dead organisms. And what they found is that dead organisms and proteins from Borrelia, in fact, were much stronger than the live spirochetes at actually activating microglia. It's a big deal because the dead things are actually having more of an inflammatory response in this case. And their postulate here is that the presence of spirochetal debris in the central nervous system following antibiotics, where you've got pieces of dead bacteria now in you, can drive persistent inflammation in post-treatment Lyme syndrome. Does that sound familiar, like what you talked about earlier with this idea of persistent of antigenic debris or DNA? Again, we're seeing more studies saying that this stuff can become entrapped in the central nervous system as well as in peripheral tissue. Slide 27. So another source of ongoing inflammation is autoimmunity. And we know that autoimmunity may drive persistent symptoms in chronic Lyme and post-treatment Lyme syndrome. So as we talked about with Th17. Right, you end up for pushing this inflammatory response far enough, you actually can get a systemic autoimmune reaction, and this occurs as the literature clearly states many times. There's the idea of molecular mimicry that occurs due to cross-reactive antibodies from Borrelia surface glycoproteins that look like other proteins in our body. And a quick search on some of these things, it was very, very easy to find a number of examples of this in Borrelia and Lyme. The LFA1 protein is an autoantigen against OspA reactive Th1 cells. So the 31-kDa protein can cross-react with LFA1 and create treatment-resistant Lyme arthritis. Slide 28. There has also been shown the presence of anti-axonal antibodies in neuroborreliosis, or antibodies against axons. There is Borrelia burgdorferi specific IgM antibodies to flagellin cross-react with neuronal antigens. And in Lyme carditis, they have actually found antibodies against alpha myosin, suggesting that your heart, actually, the cardiac muscle may be attacked secondary to an autoimmune response. So again, a lot of inflammation. Slide 29. So now that we've looked at inflammation as a common denominator in bacterial persistence, we need to deal with how we're going to deal with the inflammation. How are we going to treat these patients? And there are a lot of interventions that can be used to address immune modulation. And naltrexone is an incredibly important and powerful immune modulator that almost all of the patients I see with chronic Lyme and post-treatment Lyme end up using, because it helps in assisting with everything I've talked about today. Naltrexone works through both a opioid effect as well as a non-opioid effect. And the opioid effect is that low-dose naltrexone and doses up to about 4.5 milligrams binds to the mu opioid receptor and temporarily blocks those receptors. It's there for just a few hours, maybe up to about 6 hours. And that pulsatile effect has been shown to result in an increase in native endorphins, enkephalins, as well as the opioid receptor production, known as opioid growth factor receptors. So we upregulate those things. And why is that important? Slide 30. Well, endorphins do a lot of things. They enhance analgesia, they support mood, they keep our sex drive up, they keep our appetite up, and they contribute to overall sense of well-being. It's been shown that endorphins inhibit T cell production, or inhibit T cell proliferation, as well as B cell based antibody production. Endorphins reduce pro-inflammatory cytokines while increasing immune regulation. And that's been shown by its ability to decrease TNF-alpha and increase the at levels of interleukin-10, which are associated with T regulatory cells or immune tolerance. And enkephalins, known as opioid growth factor, have been shown to promote tissue healing as well as regulating cell growth in abnormal cells. These are big deals. Slide 31. So low-dose naltrexone is a model for treating inflammatory diseases. It's been shown established efficacy in a number of known inflammatory conditions. Low-dose naltrexone has effectiveness in Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, chronic regional pain syndrome, and fibromyalgia. And it's been shown to have some of these effects in inflammation by reducing cytokines that are known to promote nociception, allodynia, and hyperalgesia. Things we've talked about, IL-6, TNF-alpha, IL-2, IL-15, IL-17, big deals here. You're starting to see the full circle of these cytokines and how damaging they can be. And we've got this incredible medication that's readily and affordably available to our patients that can directly lower these levels. Slide 32. So what about the non-opioid-based anti-inflammatory effects of naltrexone? Well, we talked about microglia and the effects that it can have on the central nervous system that can lead to pain almost anywhere in the body and contribute to immune dysfunction. Once again, naltrexone, low-dose naltrexone, can inhibit signaling of toll-like receptors by PAMP recognition on microglia. So it stops microglial activation by preventing the toll-like receptors from recognizing those pathogen-associated molecular patterns. And LDN is associated with attenuation of inflammatory cytokine production in the central nervous system. It reduces neuroinflammatory cytokines that, again, there's some common denominators here. You see IL-6 again, you'll see TNF-alpha, IL-12, NF-kappa-B, and TGF-beta, right? Well, things we talked about. chronic stimulation of toll-like receptors on microglia contributes to the genesis and pathogenesis of multiple autoimmune diseases. Big deal. You really want to keep those from being chronically stimulated. Slide 33. So low-dose naltrexone in the central nervous system can do a lot. It reduces chronic microglial activation, which can prevent neurodegeneration, as well as preventing autoimmune progression and initiation. It reduces pain sensitivity, fatigue, cognitive disturbances, sleep problems, mood disorders, and overall malaise. And it's been shown to be neuroprotective to the central nervous system by reducing reactive oxygen species and preventing chronic neuroexcitation with like glutamate-based neuroexcitation. Slide 34. So low-dose naltrexone in chronic inflammatory response in infectious illness or even likely environmental illness as well, like mold, is probably something that needs to be talked about a lot more because it has so many benefits. It modulates the immune system through endorphins and enkephalins. It reduces inflammation by inhibiting pro-inflammatory cytokines. We know it directly downregulates Th17 and prevents autoimmune progression and genesis. And it promotes tissue healing by stimulating metenkephalin levels, as well as upregulating opioid growth factor receptor production. Slide 35. In chronic Lyme and post-treatment Lyme syndrome, low-dose naltrexone has, as I summarize all of these effects and as I conjecture on how that may be, it improves immune tolerance to a continuing antigenic presence. This is a big deal. If we accept the idea that we cannot eliminate this bacteria from our body, we need to learn to live with it. So we want to promote immune tolerance. We want that interleukin 10, that T regulatory system, to be working well. And lowering things like TGF-beta-1 and possibly CCL19 might be a role of how that happens with LDN. It can reduce the likelihood of developing autoantibodies, lowering the Th17 response, reducing IL-23. LDN can enhance immune competency by balancing the Th1 and Th2 response so that you're not dominant on one of those or the other, creating inflammation, because you can ultimately have inflammation by an overexpressed response on either branch of these immune arms. And we know that it reduces TGF, IL-2, IL-4, IL-10, and TNF-alpha, all things that can help modulate the immune system. Slide 36. LDN can reduce neurologic and musculoskeletal pain and fatigue. We know that endorphins help enormously in this level. It's possible that by cutting down on C4A, that might contribute. It can ameliorate neuroinflammatory symptoms, cutting down on IL-6, TNF-alpha, NF-kappa-B. Those are things that are critical to cutting inflammation in the brain. LDN can stimulate healing in already damaged tissue. If you've had chronic Lyme and you get treated appropriately, you stop the pathogen-mediated damage to the tissue, well, you still have had damage done that may need to be repaired. Your knee is still going to hurt if it's been eroded upon for years of infection. LDN can stimulate healing in those tissues through OGF and OGF receptors. And again, the endorphins from LDN can result in improved mood, energy, sleep, and well-being. And it cannot be understated how important your mood is in dictating your immune system and your outcomes. And so supporting that can be a huge, huge factor. So as we've talked today, clearly low-dose naltrexone in both chronic and post-treatment Lyme syndrome is an incredible tool and something that I hope all the practitioners out there listening today will begin using in their own patients. I think you won't be disappointed, and I think that you'll find that it's incredibly synergistic with therapies, whether you're using antimicrobials in these chronic Lyme cases, or whether you're wanting to use other immune modulating therapies in these post-treatment cases, like again, you know, low dose immunotherapy or slit therapy or ozone or whatever else it's going to be. Naltrexone is an important piece here. Slide 37. So I wanted to thank everyone out there listening, and I wanted to thank Linda today for asking me to speak again on the uses of naltrexone in my own patients. It's been an honor and a pleasure to talk to you all today. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.